condemnation. A better world's in birth.
On February 22nd, 2020, just a few weeks ago, after his victory in the Democratic primary in Nevada, Bernie Sanders said in a speech, quote, "I want to thank our rank-and-file union members." Notably, he did not thank the unions themselves. One of these unions, the Culinary Union, came out explicitly against Sanders' signature Medicare for All campaign proposal. Despite that, a majority of the Culinary Union's members appear to have voted for Sanders. The Nevada vote revealed a wider tension between some unions in the US and their members on issues like healthcare, a tension which may grow during the pandemic. For socialists and the labor movement in the US generally, this raises the question, do unions still make us strong? My name is Sanjeev Gupta, and this is Socialism in the Time of Corona. In this podcast, I'm talking with people with deep experience in socialist and progressive politics, especially in the US. Our overarching question is, during this pandemic, how might we not only defend whatever gains we've made to this point, but actually advance them? My guests this month include Doug Henwood, writer and host of the podcast Behind the News, Francis Boyes and Eric Blanc, organizers with the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, Mike Elk, editor of the Payday Report, and Ruth Milkman, labor sociologist at the City University of New York. During the layoffs over the last few weeks, workers in restaurants and hotels in what is called the leisure and hospitality sector have been the hardest hit by these layoffs. One of the most successful unions in this sector, Unite Here, estimates that more than 90%, that's 90, of its 300,000 plus members have been laid off in this period. Unite Here, along with some other large unions, supports legislation to extend members' employment-based health benefits, called COBRA, while these members are unemployed. But is that the best strategy for unions? I asked Francis Boyes, who is particularly well-equipped to take on this question. Francis is a former union representative with Unite Here, and is also a member of the board of Mass Care, which is the Massachusetts statewide coalition for single-payer healthcare. Francis is also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA. Full disclosure, I am also a DSA member. However, this podcast has no logistical, financial, or political connections with the DSA.
Unite Here is in a particularly unique position in the labor movement. I don't think any other union, any other major union, is faced with the you know, essentially the majority, almost 100% of their membership has been temporarily wiped out. Most unions are diverse enough, or the stronger unions in this country represent members that are continuing to work, right? Educators and healthcare employees. So those unions are flat out in a very different way. They're responding to everyday crises in the workplace that there's very, and there's tons of holes with that too, with how responding to COVID in the workplace is just, it's chaos and disaster right now. But but at least they still have their revenue streams. People are still working, so they're still getting dues. So Unite Here is in a particularly unique place where their revenue stream has been completely cut off, and the future is very uncertain for the industries they represent. So, like, we know gaming is going to come back, but when it comes back, how is it going to phase back in? When are people going to go spend money in casinos again? When are people going to be comfortable gathering? So even when the economy, quote unquote, opens back up, it doesn't mean that overnight Unite Here is going to see its membership returning to anything resembling normal. It's going to be a process. So unfortunately, they're having to do things like divert resources from strike funds into the operating budgets of a lot of affiliates around the country that just can't sustain themselves. And they've gone through massive layoffs. There's no organizing right now happening in their key industries. So I don't know what the percentage is, but the majority of organizers of Unite Here have at the affiliate level and those that are directly working for the international have been laid off until who knows when. You know, how do you organize if you're on an underground campaign at a hotel, how do you organize? You can't go to someone's home.
Yeah.
You know, you can't pull five or six workers together in a meeting to talk strategy. In many cases, they're not even reporting to work. So they're not, there's no union building activity to be done. So any new organizing happening right now is on hold, I would think, for any union. Mm-hmm. And then add to that, you know, different regulatory agencies and, you know, aren't even functioning, right? The NLRB is essentially not functioning right now. It remains to be seen what the future of that agency is going to be. So anyway, so yeah, that's a very long answer to that question. But yeah, Unite Here is in a particularly tough spot.
So I was, yeah. So I wasn't going to ask you this, but it seems like a natural follow-up now. I mean, do you think it's not in the way the Republicans talk about reopening the economy, but given the numbers of people who are simply not, you know, employed, at least in the hospitality and, you know, the hotel industry. I mean, I'm sure people are finding or trying to find other kinds of work. But is it totally outrageous to be, you know, for people to be wondering when things can start reopening and maybe planning for that even before there is a totally safe, like, vaccine and treatment? I mean, is that completely outrageous to be thinking about?
No, of course not. Of course that's, I mean, I understand why, it's not. It's not outrageous to be thinking about that because we're basically being posed with two alternatives, and that's it. You know, there's two solutions, right? You either keep things, you keep, you know, strict social or physical distancing measures intact, and you keep non-essential businesses shut down, which, by the way, this essential versus non-essential is bullshit. I've learned that. Dealing with manufacturing, I learned a lot about that designation. Doesn't really mean anything, and I can get into that later. But I think, you know, when we're presented with this idea of, like, you maintain strict physical distancing, you keep non-essential businesses from operating, and we can, you know, ride this out better. And then the other solution is just act like everything is normal and let the virus rip through the population. No one's talking about an alternative solution is, like, let's make sure everyone's taken care of, and then we will give us the tools to make the smart decisions, right? Give us the tools to be able to practice good public health policy. Give us the financial security that we need in our households so that people aren't feeling like they should be making a decision, you know, do I report back to my work or and risk putting my family in jeopardy, or, you know, I mean, it's just, or do I lose my house because I can't pay my mortgage and, you know, whatever. So, you know, there's all these, like, kind of false choices, I think, being presented to people. And we're not talking about the solutions are out there. You have, you know, there has to be, like, a massive safety net has to be implemented now. And we have to stop thinking about people's well-being and their ability to survive being tied to their ability to work. Like, if anything has shown us in modern times that we have to unlink working from survival, like, this is it. So I think, of course, people, and of course there are people in Unite Here that very much want to see the economy, quote unquote, open back up, because they're rightfully so very worried about the organization and its viability, its ability to live to fight another day. But I think that, in this, you know, to kind of pivot I think that their Unite Here, like many other unions, is missing the point. It's not about the survival of any one worker's organization. It's about taking a moment where capitalism is exposed and so raw, and then using what you've learned about organizing over the years successfully as an institution, and then using your institutional resources to then advance that movement. And I think what we've seen, I guess out of necessity, so it feels really difficult to criticize unions right now, to criticize Unite Here, especially right now. It seems it's really hard for me to do that, but there's been no, from what I can tell, there's been no conversation about pivoting from just how, you know, the conversation about how do we survive. And I just, this is not a time to just focus on how do we kind of hunker down and survive and then see what world we emerge into when this crisis is over, or when we create a new normal. I think it's like, it's the conversation should be, how do we design that world right now? We're in a moment where we, where labor unions, right, you know, working people organizations, they know how to both, well, they know how to build, right? They know how to build power. They haven't been doing it successfully for a long time in great, like in, you know, they haven't been able to amass enough power, right? But they know how to build power. And so it's like, this is a time where I think the conversation should be pivoting to doing that. And unfortunately, I'm not seeing that happen. There are a few, you know, I think the UE is, you know, through Labor Notes is kind of the first union I've seen out the gate saying we have to take this moment and run with it. But that's the UE. They represent like 30,000 people across the country. And they've always been, you know, they've always been who they are, which is not kind of a mainstream powerful player in organized labor. So, and some people would say, well, yeah, they, you know, they can afford to take that position. So anyway, but yeah, so I haven't seen a lot of unions, powerful unions, making moves in that direction, which is what disturbs me the most about the moment we're in. So
that was a really skillful pivot, and it's exactly the kinds of things that have been on my mind. So let's talk about that some more. I mean, from the point of view of particular unions, so understandably the initial impulse will be defensive, and not only in terms of whatever one might think about particular union leaderships protecting themselves, but even that aside, just, you know, the members and, you know, especially when the crisis hits so hard and fast. I mean, there's no preparation, there's, you know, no lead time. And what you're saying, and I resonate with this, is that it is also a moment to, you know, say something about, like, well, why don't we have a more comprehensive safety net generally, so that when something like this happens, we don't have to invent it out of whole cloth. Is it reasonable to ask unions to sort of, how can we realistically expect unions to move in the direction that you're suggesting, from the initially defensive impulse to the, like, what is it about unions' history in this country, maybe now we should be talking about specific unions, but even generally, what kinds of precedents are there for something like that? And even if there aren't, like, what capacities exist now that could be built on?
All right. Yeah. I think that in order to start even thinking about that question, people have to understand the reality of where unions fit right now. And so in my experience with leftist, you know, community organizers or activists, and then with kind of entrenched union leadership, there are so there's this view, you know, from people that have, that don't have any kind of deep experience understanding how the sausages are made in a union, you know, there's this, I have this experience that there are two very simplistic views of unions. The first is, almost like a deferential approach from the left, like, oh, the unions, A, unions are great, and we all want to support the unions, and B, we recognize that unions are fragile in a sense because density is very low. The campaign to keep people, to keep workers from organizing has been incredibly successful. And so there's this idea like we have to protect what's left, like unions are very fragile. And so there is this deference from the left, which I think is problematic because those same groups or people, and you know, individually or an organization, they tend to assume or look to unions for leadership when it comes to working class movements. And why would you look to an institution for leadership when you don't have any idea how they're actually operating? Because most unions are incredibly secretive about how their decisions are made, right? There's all messaging, and you know, I'm not going to say it's not smoke and mirrors, but like I said, the sausages are made, and people don't want. I'm not saying people should see that, but it's funny because people, these, you know, people in that group, they tend to look at it like, okay, you were just going to follow the unions. Well, you know, I think there needs to be a much more critical understanding of the fact that every union in this country is operating from the box it was placed in by capital. We accepted that compromise legislatively. We accepted the regulations, and we have accepted over time the erosion of our ability to be effective. And when I say that because when you're representing members of a union, you have all these legal obligations to fulfill all these duties where, for example, a state or federal enforcement mechanism might fail. The union's on the hook, technically, legally, for mitigating that failing. And so, like, they just more and more is dumped onto a union, more and more responsibility within the you know, the capitalist framework, right? We're kind of we're put in this box, and all this responsibility is being dumped on us. It is very hard to have the energy and time to think about how to get out of that box, and it's very uncertain what the hell it would look like for any union that tries to get out of that box, because then you've got like the full attention of capital, you know, like any tactic that's going to get you out of bounds is going to be noticed, and there's going to be a swift response. And unions are not immune from federal court battles and, you know, being bankrupted by lawsuits. And, you know, I mean, all that stuff is a very real fear for unions. So point being, unions do things that are worthy of criticism. However, the reasons they're doing those things are they're very real, very legitimate reasons. It's just, it doesn't seem like anyone's figured out how to get themselves out of that box just yet. So you have that group from the left that is not willing to critically look at unions, but then is still expecting them to lead and is deferential to them. And then you have another group from the left that is hypercritical of organized labor, of big unions, without having that understanding of how everything is, how decisions are made and why they're being made. So not understanding that the box that unions are put in, and then the compromises that they're forced to make. So, and then claim as victories. I can't tell you how many compromises I claimed as a victory. And sometimes they felt good and sometimes they didn't. But so I think that, so those are the two types of people, right? And from the left, I'm not going to talk about people that are not from the left because that doesn't seem relevant. But so I think that you know, your unions are not going to engage with the like hyper uninformed critics. And they don't have to engage with the leftists that are just going to kind of blindly support them. So they're largely left on their own to determine their own strategy. And there is not a lot of collaboration amongst organized labor, unfortunately. And there's a that comes from just the ton of competition. And the each union has its own culture of criticizing what other unions are doing tactically and strategically. And, you know, so it's very tribal, I guess. Is that a word I can use? Yeah, there's like this, I don't want to say like cult-like, but anyway, you know, yeah. Each unit has their colors, right? They show up in their colors, you know. It's like the movie Warriors, the 1980s gang movie from New York, right? Everybody's got their own like outfit or identity or whatever. Anyway, So I think that we have not held unions' feet to the fire, and we've allowed this kind of false idea that they are leading in a movement, and they're not. Mm. I don't think that they have the ability to, given current circumstances. But I don't remember your original question, and I don't know if I answered it.
No, you did. You answered the first part of it, which is, you know, the we need to understand where unions are coming from. You know, and then the second part of it is so then where is, you know, the impetus going to come for the kind of shift that you're talking about, yeah, where and criticizing, you know, unions like Unite for sort of not thinking outside their own, you know, parameters.
Yeah. That is the entire reason that I just up and quit my job, you know, two weeks ago. There were many, many reasons, but this was the moment. Because I personally felt like there's a ton of organizing that can be done to kind of catapult progress right now. And I think we're at a moment where thinking small and trying things incrementally is a strategic mistake. So I wanted to free myself up personally because I didn't think I was going to be able to be a part of that while working for a union. I just don't see the desire. Yeah, I don't see in this is not, you know, it's not an indictment of unions, you know. I always get really nervous when I talk about my criticisms about unions and then specific decisions that unions make, because it could so easily be painted as anti-union rhetoric or like playing into this idea that, oh, they're terrible, they're ineffective, and just get rid of them. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying like we have to find a way. I don't know the answer to the question, and we have to find a way to, not that we have to, wouldn't it be nice if we could find a way for unions to become agents of social change? I just haven't seen that. Maybe I haven't seen that happening, I think, on the scale that I think it could, it should be happening. So, and you know, when I was having conversations about leaving my career as a union representative, you know, I talked with people who also have revolutionary politics, and they were saying, you know, people who've spent their entire careers working for a union, and they were saying, you know, that of course a lot of people come into staff jobs with unions because they have revolutionary politics. And then at some point there's some kind of like reconciliation that's supposed to happen where they then just become, they become okay with the reality of the compromises. And I don't, you know, I'm not okay with that. So I don't, you know, maybe I'm just, maybe that's naive, you know, but I feel like, and here's the other thing, like I've met like incredibly brilliant strategists, incredibly like well-meaning radicals that are in leadership positions with unions. I can't figure out why they meaning collectively the union movement cannot get it together to strategically respond in a way that opens us up for some kind of system change. I can't figure that out. You know, aside from the very obvious that unions are just run ragged, plenty of obstacles are put up in our place and, you know, in front of unions. And I think that, you just burn yourself out trying to do your day-to-day job with those obstacles in place. And, you know, but, that only speaks to the need to get the hell out of that box I was talking about before. Like it's even more urgent, you know? Yeah. So I don't know. That is the question.
Yeah.
So, and I think I'm hoping we're in a movement, right? A moment right now where, we can start to figure that out. And the one thing I can say about unions is if they're not going to pivot to become a mechanism or an agent of system change, then at least we could be hoping they stay out of our way. Which unfortunately with this new pending legislation at the federal level for insurance bailouts, basically, it doesn't look like they are going to get out of the way of the movement, which is really disappointing.
What's the insurance bailout?
So there is emergency legislation for the government to provide COBRA payments, COBRA, the continuing insurance coverage for people who've lost their group policies through their employer, to pay those directly to insurance companies. So instead of, full disclosure for anyone who doesn't know this, you know, I'm a single payer activist organizer. And so instead of unions coming together with their influence, their legislative influence, and saying, all right, now's the moment. If nothing else has shown us we need a single payer system, you know, like what other signs do we need other than this COVID crisis? But instead of doing that, Unite Here especially is doubling down on their commitment to maintaining with reforms our current healthcare system. And the latest version of that is their lobbying efforts to get COBRA payments. Now, COBRA, COBRA is basically 102% of the normal monthly premium for a group plan that is paid directly to the insurance company for continuing to provide the coverage. So we're telling, you know, laid off and unemployed workers, you're going to continue to have your coverage because clearly that's important. But you're going to have it through your same group policy that is run by a for-profit, even if it's not for-profit, it's for-profit if it's insurance, by a for-profit insurance company. We're going to bail them out instead of changing the system to make it so we don't have to put these incredibly expensive Band-Aids on crises like this in the future. So I think that this legislation particularly pisses me off. It's probably going to pass. And I understand from the sense of urgency, like people are losing insurance coverage now. It is much easier to get them the ability to continue their current insurance than it is to like redesign an entire new system. I understand that. But if that was all that was happening, especially with Unite Here, if that was all that was happening right now was they're lobbying for this, like as truly just a Band-Aid, that'd be one thing. But Unite Here has a history. Excuse me, especially over the last year of different affiliates and different leaders coming out in opposition to a single payer system, and their opposition to a single payer system has exposed their true motives, which are maintaining their own healthcare systems. So Unite Here operates multiple Taft-Hartley funds that are, you know, self-insurance funds for members. And in Las Vegas, the largest, most powerful local of Unite Here runs its own provider system. So it's the insurance carrier and it is the provider network. And so when Unite Here lobbies for COBRA payments, that's so that Unite Here can then pay its own health and welfare fund 102% of the premium. So what Unite Here and many other, I can speak a lot about Unite Here because that's where I was, but it's not unique to Unite Here. Many unions with these Taft-Hartley health and welfare funds, they are opposed to single payer systems because they've gotten themselves in the dirty business of providing health insurance and they shouldn't be in it in the first place. And I'm disappointed that they're not seeing the growing movement for single payer as their ability to have this, it should be a relief. Like, look, there's our exit strategy. We can now get out of this very grimy business of being a health insurance provider and in some cases a healthcare provider. So under our current system, if we were to say these were democratic organizations that, you know, were able to operate their own healthcare systems in very different ways without profit motives and, you know, catering to patient needs and not bottom line, that's different. But what we're talking about are unions that are kidding themselves, thinking that they've created some kind of superior alternative within our current system. It is not, it's an alternative. You can't even call it an alternative. They cut it from the same cloth. So, you know, every health and welfare fund is still subject to the same market pressures, right? They're basically paying out the claims, right? If you're going into a hospital to get a $2 million organ transplant, you know, from start to finish, then that burden, the cost of that service, it's no different whether it's Blue Cross Blue Shield paying out the claim or a health and welfare fund. It's not like you're getting a discount because it's a union-run plan. You're still subject to the same pressures of the market. You still have to make terrible decisions and compromise plan designs and benefits because the market is what it is. You have to level out the market. So why unions continue to fight to be included in that, it boggles my mind. So
is this related to Culinary's opposition to Sanders? So
that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, the culinary unions, they really stepped in it because then their membership showed how out of touch
exactly.
their leadership is, right? Which was not, it was painful to watch, but at the same time, really gave me a lot of hope. You know, I was just one very small voice within Unite Here that was angry about how Unite Here, how different powerful affiliates within Unite Here were kind of setting the narrative about single payer and about health insurance. But so on the one hand, it was like awful to watch that happen. On the other hand, it was like, you know, that was a lesson I think that every union should take something away from, right? Like they really doubled down on opposing Bernie Sanders and on opposing Medicare for All, and their membership clearly, clearly disagrees with them.
A long time ago, my life as a graduate student at a large public university in the Midwestern US was improved immeasurably by the graduate student union there. Today, as a faculty member at a large public university in the Northeast, it is difficult for me to imagine what my work would be like without our amazing faculty and staff union. No, I take that back. It's all too easy for me to imagine what it would be like, given what I know about the much more insecure working conditions of my friends in non-unionized academic environments. I'm especially appreciative of our union's strength in light of the squeeze on higher education as this pandemic goes on. And yet, unions like ours are powerless to stop the tidal wave of layoffs among adjuncts, teaching assistants, staff, and other essential workers whose existence is precarious at the best of times and who are now being thrown into one of the most barren labor markets in recent memory. And of course, even the best unions cannot protect all their members indefinitely. In this context, social protections like universal healthcare are vital. Are unions in the US capable of playing a leading role in the struggle? Next week, I continue this conversation with labor activist and author Eric Blanc about his efforts to support the wave of labor organizing among essential workers during the pandemic. Join us in thinking aloud about how our day-to-day work during Corona can cohere into a battle plan for democratic socialism after the pandemic.